I'm back where I started again. And trying to forget you was just a waste of time.
Baby, come back. Any kind of fool could see there was something in everything about you. Baby, come back. You can blame it all on me. I was wrong.
You know, that song is disturbingly apt for the topic we have today. We are talking about de-extinction. Well-chosen song by Carolyn McCusker, our producer for this episode. When Carolyn came to me to propose this episode, I said, well, we did one a few years ago. We did a de-extinction show, but it focused on an animal I'm not even going to mention today. It's the M word preceded by the adjective woolly. So we would have to do a de-extinction show that did not contain the woolly M. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the de-extinction of so many other things, ranging from the dodo to the thylacine, a.k.a. Tasmanian tiger, to Elvis, to Neanderthals. We've got a lot on our plate today. And to get us started, nobody better than Dr. Helen Pilcher, a science writer, a scientist, and an author, and the author, most significantly, for our purposes, of Bring Back the King. You see what she did there? Tyrannosaurus Rex, Elvis, et cetera. Bring Back the King, the new science of de-extinction. It would be good if I could actually pronounce the name of the topic of today's show. Dr. Helen Pilcher, welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's talk about, there is no magic formula for de-extinction, but there's two sine qua nones, right? You've got to have something approaching intact DNA, and then you got to have a place to put that DNA that is a close cousin of the extinct animal. But that doesn't mean you're good to go, right? There's a lot of steps in between those two.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. So what you need for any de-extinction project is a source of the original DNA. You need the genetic recipe. And then you need some kind of closely related species from whom you're going to borrow bits of biology. So with the dodo, we've got dodo DNA. We know the dodo's genetic sequence. And its closest living relative is the Nicobar pigeon, which is a beautiful, beautiful bird, much, much smaller than the dodo. So you've got those two starting ingredients, which is great. But along the way, you're going to need much more than that. So I can go into the details if you're interested. But one of the most significant things to consider is, suppose the scientists managed to make something approximating a little dodo chick, right? So we'll jump to that point, presume that that's possible. Now, there's quite a lot of technology that needs to be developed before that becomes possible, if it happens. But let's think about the moment that dodo chick hatches. Now, dodos were a type of pigeon. We know that all pigeons, when they first hatch, are fed a really fatty, rich croc milk, which they receive from their mum. So the very first dodo chick to hatch won't have a dodo mum. It will be born to a chicken, which I know sounds crazy. But it is possible for one species of bird to lay the egg of another. Now, that's all well and good, maybe, a bit weird, but chickens don't make croc milk. So we bring in a third species here. We've had the Nicobar pigeon, we've had the chicken. Now you're going to have a human raising these very first dodos, feeding them croc milk. And the big question here is, how does a dodo without dodo parents know to be a dodo? How does it know how to act like a dodo? And a lot of its behavior will be genetically programmed, but we can't say with certainty that it will know everything to do, because sadly, dodos went extinct long before anybody had a chance to study them scientifically. So there's all these things that we need to think about.
Right. We humans have a bad habit of saying, wow, there's a new animal we've never seen before. Let's hunt it to extinction without ever studying it.
Right.
And so we have this problem occurs over and over again. But yeah, in the case of the dodo, we should say the dodo is from an island near Madagascar. One thing we know that its mother didn't teach it is stay away from Dutch and Portuguese sailors, which is good advice generally anyway. But so that's what happened. They were hungry. Sometimes they would kill them just for their gizzards. It's the whole thing. It's just a nightmare. But my sense of this is that introducing egg laying into the de-extinction conversation adds another layer of complexity. It's a little bit different than, and maybe we can talk about Bacardo goats and thylacines in just a second, but somehow or other, the egg thing is a little tricky.
Yeah, the egg thing, as you call it, is quite tricky. So nobody's managed to clone a bird for various reasons. Cloning birds, very, very tricky, hasn't been done. So some of the basic methods, and I say basic in inverted commas because there's nothing basic about them, but some of the methods being used to bring back the woolly M word or the thylacine, some of those methods you can't apply to birds. So you need to do it slightly differently in birds. And that involves taking a very early embryonic cell from the Nicobar pigeon, from the dodo's relative, editing that so it becomes dodo-like. Then you put that cell into an embryonic chicken. And when that chicken grows up, the chicken starts to produce either dodo eggs, if it's a female, or dodo sperm, if it's a male. And then when a chimeric, a weird mummy chicken loves a weird chimeric daddy chicken very much, and they get together, the offspring, in theory, would be a dodo. So I've simplified it there, but yes, that is basically it. It's a complicated process and it involves three species rather than two. But the chicken is really just being used as a vessel, if you like, to produce the sperm and the egg and to nurture the egg inside the shell as the bird develops.
We had a question from our vast studio audience about crop milk. Crop milk is what the certain birds kind of regurgitate into their babies' mouths, right?
Exactly right, crop milk, yeah. So it's this very lipid, rich, fatty stuff, which is regurgitated from the mum to the newly hatched bird. So a chicken couldn't do that for a dodo. But in theory, you know, there are so many things that need to be developed and thought about for this project. But one of the things is, what do you feed these birds when they first hatch? And there are people who hand rear pigeons, so it's possible. But again, we don't know for sure what the recipe for dodo crop milk was, because nobody, as you say, nobody had a chance to study it before it went. So, you know, how do we look after these fledglings if and when they're born? How do they learn how to be dodos? Where do you release them? Massive question. You know, Mauritius has lost about 60% of its forest cover. So we're going to have to think very carefully about where they go. And so the post-hatching care, you know, what's the purpose of this? Who looks after these birds? How are they treated? You don't want to bring something back from extinction just for it to be stared at in a zoo. And I don't think anyone's suggesting that. It needs to play an ecological role. So there's all these things that people need to think about.
Right. And so I think for a lot of people, the very idea of de-extinction seems like pie, possibly topped with crop milk in the sky. Whereas, in fact, I mean, it's been done. I mean, the Bacardo goat, it was a very brief de-extinction. It was like a de-extinction for a cup of tea. But it was done,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so the Bacardo was this subspecies of mountain goat that went extinct around about the turn of the millennia. Scientists had already collected some cells from the last living female. So they had some DNA and they had some cells. They used those cells for cloning, took hundreds of attempts. So lots of failed attempts, lots of embryos that didn't make it. But they did have one little Bacardo, one de-extinct Bacardo that was born. She was an exact copy of the animal that they cloned her from, more or less. She survived for, like you say, roughly the amount of time it takes to make a cup of tea. And then very sadly, she died from respiratory failure. And we think that that was linked to the cloning process. So the Bacardo wasn't just the first animal to be de-extinct. It was the first animal ever to go extinct twice.
And when we're going to be talking to Ben Lamb from Colossus in the second segment here, and I think there's some interesting questions about sort of, you know, just even how you care for a newborn de-extincted creature, and what part of fundraising might include that. But I think also it would be interesting to talk about, I mean, once again, some of the more recently de-extincted species are probably easier to get at. So let's just take a moment for the thylamine, a.k.a. the Tasmanian tiger, which is a stupid name because it wasn't a tiger. So this is something, it's about 100 years out now from extinction, something around that?
Yeah, off the top of my head, it was around about 1904. It was the early 20th century it went extinct, again, after a long history of human persecution. And it's another one of the colossal projects. Really, really interesting because this animal was a marsupial. So it could be the first marsupial to be de-extinct if that goes ahead. We've got its DNA. There are some marsupial relatives that you might be able to use for that kind of like additional species that you need. And interestingly, the closest living relative is, I forget its name, but it's basically an animal that is much, much smaller. And you go, whoa, like, well, hang on a minute.
It's like the size of a mouse, right? It's a mouse size.
A numbat or something. Ben will tell you. But of course, marsupials give birth to these tiny, tiny youngsters. You know, there's the size of a bean or a grain of rice, and then they crawl up and into their mother's pouch. So actually, that could be quite a blessing in terms of the scientists who were trying to make this happen, because you don't have to implant it in the womb of a surrogate animal. You just need some kind of furry pouch where it could hang out and have some milk. And I'm being flippant. That's not a trivial thing to arrange. But again, you know, I see a lot of the media attention around these projects, and I'm really interested to hear from Ben how much attention to detail they are paying to further down the line if and when these animals are created. Now, I know the team of scientists there are hugely responsible and very good at what they do, and are interested at bringing stakeholders like ecologists and community members into the discussion. And we have to have those people on board, because we need to make sure these projects go beyond the lab science and have the interests of the animals at stake, not just for their lifetime, but for the lifetime of the whole of their de-extincted species. You know, where are these species going to live for the next few hundred years? Who will be taking care of them? Will they be safe? Will they be subject to the same extinction pressures? You know, what drove them to extinction the first time round? Is that likely to get them again? Because just jumping back to the dodo, sure, they were clubbed around the head and eaten by Portuguese sailors. But one of the biggest problems for the dodo was all the invasive species that the Europeans brought to Mauritius. And there are still a lot of invasive species that could compete and potentially eat dodo chicks if they ended up back in the wild.
Right.
The Tasmanian tiger, it was basically hunted to extinction. So how will people welcome the Tasmanian tiger back when they might see it as a threat to their livestock? There's not very much evidence, I have to say, that it was a threat to people's livestock. But, you know, we need to be thinking about these long-term welfare questions. And the other thing I'd just like to bring into the debate at this point as well, we also need to be thinking, what's the purpose of doing this? Why are we doing this? And there are lots of different reasons why you might think de-extinction would be a good idea. But for me, there's only one compelling reason. And it's not that we have some moral obligation or that we should, you know, we can do it. For me, the only viable reason for this is an argument about biodiversity. So if you bring de-extinct creatures back, you boost biodiversity. And if you choose that species really, really careful, so if you make it what people call a keystone species, which means that that animal creates opportunities for other species to thrive, and you bring it back, you're boosting biodiversity, not just because you brought that species back, but because it will help other species to thrive too. So I think there is this quite compelling ecological narrative behind bringing some of these species back. But, and here's the thing, do we know enough about their ecology to be sure that the benefits for the environment and for biodiversity outweigh the costs, both to, you know, monetary, but also more importantly to animal welfare. And, you know, a lot of animals will not make it through the laboratory process of their creation. So there's this much sort of bigger pull, I think, that we need to think about, basically. But for me, the ecological thing is really exciting. The other last point I'll make is that all of these techniques that scientists are developing now to de-extinct animals, we're not about to have a de-extinct animal tomorrow. These are things that are being developed. But for me, the most exciting thing isn't about bringing back a dodo. It's about applying the technology that scientists are developing to endangered species, so to the species that we already have. So this technology that Colossal are developing to bring back the dodo, some of the methods that they are developing could be applied to endangered species that are still with us now. And that, for me, is actually the thing that I think is the most exciting.
Yeah, something like the white rhino, where you can catch it while it's falling, not pick it up after it hit the ground. That seems more promising and more workable and eminently desirable. Hey, before we run out of time, so I'm from a fairly small family. I don't have a lot of relatives, a lot of living relatives, and I've been told by 23andMe that my Neanderthal DNA is rather high. So I'm just thinking, you know, when Carolyn first proposed this show, I said, well, what about Neanderthals? Could we get Neanderthals back too, as long as we're de-extincting things? Obviously, there are just massive ethical questions here, but give us a quick, you know, 3-minute trip through some of the considerations here.
Right. Okay. So the first thing to say is no one's thinking about doing this. You mentioned Elvis at the top of the show as well. Likewise,
we will get to Elvis. All right.
Okay. So Neanderthals, no one is thinking about doing it, but I was interested in it as a thought experiment in my book. And I spoke to one of the leading scientists who now works with Colossal about this. One of the really kind of amusing things is, so Neanderthals, obviously an extinct species of human, very similar to us genetically. We know more about human developmental biology than we do any other species. No one has ever cloned a human. No one should ever clone a human. Many, many reasons why that's a terrible idea. But actually, do you know what? Probably it's going to be far more difficult to clone a woolly mammoth than it is to clone a human, precisely because we've been studying human embryology so closely for a long time. So could you bring back a Neanderthal? In theory, you could. Should you? Well, I would argue it's a fairly pointless procedure, as well as being, you know, immoral, unethical, and probably dangerous to the new Neanderthal and to the surrogate mum. There's really no point. So we have this idea of Neanderthals being these loincloth-wearing thugs that used to just club each other around the head. Now we realise they were actually pretty sophisticated. And I think if anyone did bring a Neanderthal back and expect that they'd be watching an episode of The Flintstones, they would be really disappointed to find out that they wouldn't be so different to us. After all, you'd be raising a Neanderthal in a very different world, you know, instead of stone tools and arrows, they'd be playing with iPads and computer consoles, and we'd probably find they weren't so different to us after all. So what would we learn from that? You know, not very much. So yeah, not in favor of it, but as a thought experiment, I thought it was kind of an interesting one to look at.
Well, it's not true that nobody's thinking about de-extincting Neanderthals, because I'm thinking about de-extincting.
I
don't have anything to bring to the party, but I'm thinking about it. All right. So another thought experiment that you did, and it wasn't exactly fully confined to the arena of thought, was bringing back the other king. Yes, there's Tyrannosaurus Rex, but there's also Elvis. So tell us a little bit about the way you dipped your toe into that question.
Right. So again, I just thought, wow, what an interesting thought experiment. If you can bring back a Neanderthal in theory, how about we choose a person from the past? Could we clone them? Could we bring them back? Now, again, no one's doing this. It's unethical. It's immoral. It's a dreadful idea for lots of reasons. So I put that caveat out there first. But could you do it, right? So I went on eBay And I bought a sample of Elvis Presley's hair.
I hope you were very, very careful about that, because an awful lot of the Elvis hair on eBay is actually from Roy Orbison. That's come out. But.
Well, that could explain a lot of things, actually. I'm not convinced it was genuine. But anyway, so the question is, if you have a single strand of somebody's hair, can you get enough DNA from it to get a high quality copy of their genetic sequence? The answer is yes, you can. And if you've got that high quality copy, could you, for example, work out what all the bits were that were unique to Elvis that no one else had and edit them into a human cell? The answer is yes, in theory. Could you use that cell for cloning? Yes, in theory. You would then have a little embryo that is basically a twin brother to the original Elvis, but obviously born, you know, many, many decades apart. And then a woman carries that little embryo to term and a baby is born. So then you've got this really interesting thought experiment, similar to the Neanderthals, with how Elvis or not would this kid be? And how much is who we end up to be as people down to our genetics and the environment? You know, what if this kid, who incidentally would have a dreadful life under the spotlight, like the Truman Show right. on acid, it would be horrific.
You think Prince Harry thinks he had it bad.
This
would be
exactly.
so much worse. And you'd want to time the birth for June, so you'd have sort of a second Christmas in the middle of the middle of the year. But yeah, I think the question that you're posing is, you know, you can make a thylacine, you can make a Tasmanian tiger, but what did its mother and its siblings or whoever teach it? You know, does it know to go eat a Tasmanian devil? And you can make another Elvis, but what would it know? You know, what if it were caught in a trap and it couldn't get out?
What if it was clonesome tonight? I mean, so many questions.
All right, you topped me on that one. That was pretty good. Yes, would it know how to make a peanut butter and banana sandwich?
Would it be more into drum and bass and R&B than rock and roll? Would it prefer trainers over blue suede shoes? You know, what if this kid has a throat infection when he's 5 years old and he never sings a note, you know? This, you know, and this experiment has already been done around the world many times over, in that identical twins we know may look the same, but they grow up into two very different people. So we can never bring back Elvis. And in the book, I tell the lovely statistical story of how there's no point bringing back Elvis, because when Elvis was born, there were no Elvis impersonators. At the point of his death, there were about 150 Elvis impersonators. In 2012, there were about 43,000 Elvis impersonators. And if you plot that on a graph, you get an exponential curve, which means that the number of Elvis impersonators is now increasing so rapidly that in about 30 years' time, every single person on the planet will be an Elvis impersonator. So we don't need to bring him back, because, you know, very soon we'll all be singing Jailhouse Rock.
Yeah, either that, or if you're an Elvis impersonator right now and you just heard those numbers, you should be working on a Harry Styles. which is also a very good name for a Neanderthal. All right, we have to stop. It's too much fun. It's too much fun with you, Dr. Helen Pilcher, scientist and clearly comedy writer, author of Bring Back the King, The New Science of De-Extinction. Thank you so much for being with us. We will come back with the aforementioned Ben Lamb. He's the CEO of the company that's going to do some of this stuff.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Yes, they have Cher playing all day long at the headquarters of Colossal. We're going to talk to its CEO right now, Ben Lamb. Colossal, a company which he co-founded with George Church, who I might add, I believe was consulted by Helen about the Elvis project and said it was not infeasible. I'm going to put it that way. So, Ben Lamb, first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Thanks so much for having me. I was listening on and Helen made some great points.
Well, we should talk about those points, but maybe we should just begin by the idea of what is Colossal. Explain how this company came about.
Yeah, so I'm fortunate enough to be one of the co-founders and CEO, but Colossal is, I think, the world's first de-extinction company. I think a lot of people have been talking about de-extinction and looking at new technologies for species preservation of critically endangered species, but I think we may be the first company trying to go after these things. And it came about with my background is building companies, technology companies, kind of at the brink of the next wave of innovation with much smarter people than me. And I reached out to George to talk to him about a completely different project. He got me excited about ecosystem restoration and biodiversity reintroduction and bringing back mammoths. And, you know, before you know it, I left my last CEO position and followed him on this.
It would seem to me, and from what I also know about Colossal, this is an unusual company in the sense that you kind of have to build out the entire production line from the germ of an idea to the emplacement of some kind of finished, imagined creature into a habitat, right? There just aren't a lot of subcontractors available to do the stuff that you're talking about doing.
Yeah, it's a full infrastructure, right? Like a lot of incredible scientists from around the world have done research on ancient DNA. They've done work on embryology. They've done work on, you know, genetic engineering tools, stem cell reprogramming and induced pluripotent stem cell work. There's been a lot of great animal husbandry work and you know, conservation zoos are like doing a lot of work with top NGOs in that field, like trying to help critically endangered species. But you have to build all of the infrastructure. And so a lot of times people ask, well, why did you guys raise $225 million is because we, you know, we have over 107 scientists, but we had to build all of those disciplines, right? Because if we get to the genome of a mammoth and we get to the cells of a mammoth, but we don't have a way to, you know, work with animal husbandry in order to grow a mammoth, then that's not going to be successful, right? Like you don't get a mammoth with part of these projects. The pieces of the project, you have to build the entire infrastructure. And I do think that it's a systems problem. And, you know, several of the co-founders come from software. And so saw a lot of software problems are systems problems. So I think coming from a different world outside of biology, let us take a new, bring a new lens to the problem.
It seems to me that one of the hardest things to anticipate is one of the things that Helen was talking about. So let's say that you make a thylacine, that's the Tasmanian tiger. And so presumably you're going to, at some point, maybe people are going to want to introduce it into the habitat it used to inhabit. And there are some good things that could come out of that. For example, Tasmanian devils, also a wrongly named species, have some kind of weird face cancer that they transmit to each other. And, you know, if you could suppress the population a little bit, maybe you could stabilize it. That there's things on an ideal basis that reintroducing a form of predation could accomplish, but it's a little bit of a shot in the dark, right? You don't really know that it would play out the same way again.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about in what Helen was referring to is kind of intended versus unintended consequences, right? And really understanding that. So you mentioned Tasmanian devils. I was fortunate enough last August to reintroduce Ned, You know, Ned was the 21st Tasmanian devil being reintroduced without the facial tumor disease back into mainland Australia, right? And we worked with the incredible team at WildArc, at AussieArc to do it. And what was interesting is it's a very gated process, right? So these rewilding initiatives aren't just you make Tasmanian devils, or in the case of the thylacine, you bring back the thylacine, you make a bunch of them, you open up the doors, and then you cross your fingers, right? It's a very thoughtful, you know, there's ecologists involved, there's indigenous people groups involved, there's governments, there's other scientists, there's animal welfare folks involved. It's a very collaborative process. And so we've started to work, you know, with different groups in Australia to understand their rewilding processes, you know, of existing but threatened and endangered marsupials. And then, you know, for us, even though we don't have thylacines today, we don't have dodos today, and we don't have mammoths today, we are actively engaging with local governments, indigenous people groups, fish and wildlife or the equivalent thereof in country, EPA or the equivalent thereof in country, and the public at large. You know, so we're working with the Alaskan government, we're working with the Mauritian government, and then for the dodo, obviously. And then we're working very closely with the Tasmanian government. I'm actually going to be back with the Tasmanian government in October of this year. And so even though we're years away from having thylacines and even further away from reintroducing back to the wild, we're starting those conversations now, because it's not about, you know, hoping for the best with reintroduction or hoping to get, you know, approval in the future. It's really about collaborating from day one.
So the dodo is a fairly recent addition, as I understand it, to Colossal's game plan. Talk about why that happened and what the special challenges are. I used the phrase the egg thing to Helen, who seemed to find that acceptable, if an insufficient way to describe the problem. But first of all, talk about why. How did the dodo get back on the...
go ahead. I'll tell you how it came to be, and then we can talk about the challenges and opportunities that I think can come from it. So how it came to be is, you know, we have an incredible group of investors like Thomas Sowell and Jim Breyer and others. And in our board meetings and in our investor reports, we show the progress that we're making on our mammalian species, being the mammoth and the thylacine. And some of the work, when you start to bring all the people we've brought together worldwide from some of these top research groups, as well as the infrastructure and the teams and technologies that we've acquired, we're making progress at a faster rate than we've set expectations publicly on. And the investors were excited. And so we got feedback from our investors of, if you were to take on a third species, what would it be and why? We feel like the dodo is not only a case that, you know, it went extinct due to man's introduction of invasive species into Mauritius and some hunting, but mostly introduction of invasive species. But fundamentally, you know, it is the symbol of man-made and man-caused extinction events of biodiversity, right? And so we felt if we were a de-extinction company, it's something that we should work on. It was also a great excuse to start working on the challenges that come with avian de-extinction work, which I can talk about. And our lead paleogeneticist, Beth Shapiro, who ironically wrote the book, How to Clone a Mammoth, which, spoiler alert, ends with you can't clone a mammoth. That was a point that Helen brought up. It would be harder. You cannot clone mammoths. You have to engineer them from traits that you, in genetic analysis of the genomes. You can't just straight up clone them, because we don't have the full genome or living cells. So Helen was 100% right on that. It's not even hard. It's you know, currently impossible. But what I will say is, what's interesting is that Beth actually worked on the mammoth, on the dodo genome for 15 plus years. And so we have this incredible, you know, feedback and support from our investors. We wanted to get into working on avian genomics at some point. And, you know, we had Beth Shapiro as one of our lead paleogeneticists and scientific advisory board members that's been helping us with our various projects, who also had the dodo genome. And so it was kind of the perfect storm for us to say, okay, well, if we get additional capital, we can, you know, stand up an avian genomics group and go after it.
So before we run out of time here, one thing that you kind of hinted at the beginning of our conversation, but is worth mentioning now, every time you have to solve a problem, I mean, this is like a moonshot, right? And the one thing about the space program is that it just threw off all kinds of technology that we now take for granted. I'm assuming as you're solving these problems, software, hardware, wetware, I mean, if you have to get really good at making stem cells, the possible spinoff from that is not limited to extinct animals.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. And so for us, it's twofold. Any technologies that we make on the path to de-extinction that have an application to conservation, we're open sourcing, giving to the world for free. It's just important. Like, you know, there's not enough money and technologies going into we are fighting a current century war with many, many, many years of centuries past strategies on loss of biodiversity. So conservation groups need new technologies. So anything that we develop for conservation, we're just giving to the world and open sourcing, because we want to help it, give new tools to those conservation groups. But to your point, anything that we make that has an application to human healthcare, we are going to spin out and create new companies with. And we did that last year. So we found a huge gap in the market around computational biology in building the right system that we needed to do genomic analysis and do targeting and planning and some of the things that that we were working on at Colossal. So we actually spun that company out, raised separate capital for that business. It's called Form Bio. Just announced a major partnership yesterday or the day before with Google. And it's going really well. And we hope that technology helps, you know, with everything from, you know, de-extinction to cancer research to small molecule design. And I think that will also happen with some of our genetic engineering tools, some of our stem cell work, as well as some of our hardware work.
Ben Lamb, this has been fascinating. I just got my Social Security check. I'm going to send you $3,000. CEO of the de-extinction company Colossal, which he co-founded with George Church. Thank you so much for spending some time today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right. We'll be back in 5 years to talk about Stellar's sea cow. But right now, we got to take a break because you might want to think about plants, too. Plants, well, first of all, there are a lot of different kinds of plants, and we need some of them more than we even understand.
Swear I was born right in the doorway. I went out in the rain, suddenly everything changed. They're spreading blankets on the beach. Yours is the first face that I saw. I think I was blind before I met you. And I don't know where I am, I don't know where I've been, but I know where I want to go. And so I thought I'd let you know.
Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
All right. Special thanks to our technical producer, Kat Pastor. Also, Dylan Ray has contributed, as usual, some very interesting pre-show music. And Carolyn McCusker, our newest producer, has done an amazing job of producing this episode. Our senior producer is Lily Tyson. I guarantee you she's floating around somewhere doing something very responsible. It's now time to talk about plants. And plants kind of get lost in the shuffle a little bit because people go, I want a mastodon. Who cares about plants? Well, guess what? Mastodon's going to have to eat something. Carlos De La Rosa is the president and CEO of the Center for Plant Conservation. He joins us now. Hello, sir.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you have a great kind of metaphor for all this. It's the metaphor of a library and the toilet paper. So tell us that the parable of the library and the toilet paper.
Oh, boy. That's an old metaphor that I used a long time ago, but let's see if I can remember where my mind was at that time. We have a tremendous amount of biodiversity in this planet, and at the base of life on Earth, basically, all animals and all that, we depend a lot on plants, which has this unique capacity to take sunlight and make stuff out of it. And that stuff, it's the basis of the life of on our planet. It's the food for many animals, which become themselves food for other ones. And the diversity of plants in the planet is extraordinary. And in some ways, we just depend on plants for most of our life. Without plants, we will not be able to exist as humans or as animals. There are a lot of plants, according to most scientific work that has been done. There's about between 370 and almost 400,000 vascular plant species on Earth. And most of these, 370 or so thousand, are flowering plants, which is, and many of our foods come from them.
So to steer you towards your metaphor, so this is like having a library containing 8.5 million unique original manuscripts. And the problem is we don't know what the manuscripts are, and yet we're going to take a shelf of them every week and make them into toilet paper. So the risk is we don't even know what we're converting from a living useful thing into a non-useful thing.
Absolutely, that is the tragedy of not knowing what our biodiversity is. If we figure that we have about 8 million species on Earth, and we have so many of them are unknown. We only know about 2.5 million species, perhaps even less than that, that we have named. There are a lot of species out there that we have not given names to. And by not giving them names, this is what my metaphor was, that we have original manuscripts, not copies of books, original manuscripts, which have no titles at this point. We don't know what information they have. We don't know if they have potential to become the next type of foods, the next type of medicine, or something that we could revolutionize the way that that we humans and other animals live. But we're taking a shelf of that library full of millions of copies of original manuscripts, and then we grind them into toilet paper. It is a loss of information that took millions of years to be produced. And that is what we are trying to prevent. It's the loss of information that is critical for the survival, not just of humans, but of life on this planet.
So I think a concrete example is always good. So let's talk about the rosy periwinkle. It comes from the neighborhood of the dodo. It comes from the Madagascar rainforest. Explain what it was and what happened.
Yeah, the rosy periwinkle is a fantastic story, and it is a very personal story for some of us. And you'll see at the end of this short conversation why. It is one of those species that, when you look at it, we have domesticated it. It's found in the gardens of many people and all around the world. It's a domesticated ornamental species. Beautiful green leaves, dark green with beautiful pink, rosy flowers. Somebody noticed at some point that this plant is not eaten by many animals, that most of the leaves are always intact and eaten by herbivores. And on analysis of the contents of this plant, of the leaves, a number of alkaloids are plant poisons that the plants produce to defend themselves against herbivores, against insects or animals that would eat them. And out of all these alkaloids, all these plant poisons, two of them have potential for becoming a next generation of medicines. Many of medicines that we use in chemotherapy, for example, to treat cancers are actual poisons. It's just that you dose them in such a way that you kill the cancerous cells, but you don't kill the person by giving them these poisons. But chemotherapy is essentially the targeting of cells that are growing out of control. And this plant produces, this particular plant, the rosy periwinkle, two specific types of alkaloids, of plant poisons, that became essential for the treatment of some rather incurable types of cancer. For example, Hodgkin's disease, or testicular cancer, and other types of cancer. The rate of survival on some of these cancers were minimal, where 90-95% death when you were diagnosed with this cancer. this particular chemicals, and they gave them names based on the old name of the plant. They're called vincristine and vinblastine, became magical chemicals that cured these types of cancers that were incurable before. So the rate of survival of these cancers went from almost certain death at 95, 98% death to 95% curing, survival. And that is extraordinary. And that came from this little plant.
Wait, I should say that A, someone very, very, very close to me is currently getting vincristine infusions. And you yourself, as I understand it, are among the people who've experienced this too.
Yes. So I do owe my life to the Rosy Periwinkle. Many years ago, I was diagnosed with one of the types of cancers that this plant has been used to, and I'm completely cured. It's been 35 years since that. So for me, protecting this plant or the relatives of this plant, because that's where the story goes, and that's what I wanted to bring up, that there are seven other periwinkles in Madagascar. And Madagascar, if you look at a map, it has a lot of forests around the coastal ranges where this other seven periwinkles actually live, and they are getting deforested. These areas are being consumed by the needs for wood and for land. So they could become extinct. Now, if the rosy periwinkle, one of these, the Catharanthus roseus, of that genus Catharanthus, if that rosy periwinkle produced two major life-changing and game-changing medications to treat cancers, imagine what seven other species that evolve under different conditions and have different genes and different chemicals, what they could, what cancers could they cure? What other diseases could they cure? These seven species that are still in the wild have not been domesticated. They will become extinct at the rate of disappearance of the forest where they live. So for me, this is a personal job. I want to make sure that we have the opportunity to study these plants and protect them before they become extinct, because we're making toilet paper out of the forest, or we're making products that are not as necessary as the next generation of medicines and foods and all those things. We have exploited and developed a very small proportion of edible and medicinal plants that exist in the world. But our rate of destruction of the original habitats and forests is such that we're going to lose them before we even know what they could do for us.
So the Center for Plant Conservation, one of its tasks is to essentially maintain a database of these rare and imperiled plants that we know about and where they are currently being preserved, because you want to have multiple specimens of these plants if you're going to be able to save them.
Yeah, but it's a complex process because it involves a lot of field surveys and finding where these plants are, what these plants are. Do we know them? Do they have even names? Some of these species have not even been described yet. We discover new species all the time. Every year, there's a couple thousand species of plants and animals that get discovered and named, but we know very little about them. So we don't know the potential that they have, like the seven other periwinkles out in Madagascar. So what the Center for Plant Conservation does is organize the network of botanical gardens that serve as repositories of living collections of these plants. And these living collections could be in the form of seeds, or mostly like seed banks, or in the form of plants that are grown to produce additional seed. There are three directions that the CPC, or the Center for Plant Conservation, works. And one is that first you have to find where these plants are, try to, hopefully they are under some level of protection, and bring specimens of those plants into quote-unquote captivity, into the botanical gardens and the places where they could care for them, study them, and bank the seeds. That is a complex process because we have not surveyed all the areas where these plants could be. Habitats are disappearing very rapidly, falling to development. So we are depending on the protected areas like national parks, wildlife refuges, and private areas where these plants could exist, and then collect seeds to bring into ex situ, outside of their natural range, for study and for protection. It's our seed bank. Once you have that seed bank under protection, then you have to manage it. It's just not freeze them and hope that when you need them, they will be ready. You need to know the natural history of each of these species, because normally, we don't know enough about these plants because they're rare plants. We're looking at the rarest of the rare. We're looking at the plants that are most at risk of disappearing because their populations are so small out in the wild, and they're about to disappear if we don't do something to protect them.
We're going to have to stop there. I'm going to have to stop you there, Carlos De La Rosa, because we have unfortunately run out of time. But President and CEO of the Center for Plant Conservation, this is a mammoth undertaking, and there are many risks and perils. And if we had more time, we could tell you about herbariums that caught on fire and things like that. So you got to have duplicates. We're going to have to say goodbye. We're going to have to temporarily extinct our show, but we'll de-instinctify ourselves tomorrow for a different topic and a different show. Thanks for listening today. Baby, I'm